It's nice to be able to speak without a mask on. One perk that goes with preaching, isn't it? As Micah mentioned, my task today is basically to give a bit of an overview of the book of James, okay? It's sort of to think of it as kind of to whet your appetite for what will be coming in the subsequent Monday chapels when students deliver messages. So again, my job isn't to sort of dig deep into any particular passage. Think of it in terms of, like, we oftentimes use that expression, the forest and the trees, okay? What individual students are going to be doing later on is sort of digging deep into a particular tree, kind of giving you a kind of a closer view of individual passages. What I'm inviting you to do this morning is just get a look at the entire forest of James. Okay, so that's really what we're about this morning. Okay, let's begin. You know, oftentimes with, this is pretty well true of any book of the Bible, it's important to pay attention to how the author begins the book and how they conclude the book, because oftentimes those bookends provide you with very important clues as to what the author is seeking to do, what his main concerns are, as in this case, as James writes this letter to these churches. So let's take a minute or a second to just read the opening statement of the book. So this is what we would call the salutation of the epistle. It's pretty well standard. It's kind of typical in many ways of what you see at the beginning of these New Testament letters. But let's read that. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to, here's the recipients now, the 12 tribes in the dispersion or in the diaspora, greetings. Okay. So what I want to do is just take a few minutes to just sort of unpack what this tells us about the author and what this tells us about the recipients, okay? Because again, there's some important clues that are just sort of suggested just in the language here. So if we look at the author, look at the next slide there. The author, you know, and one thing, do you want to move forward to the next? There we go, okay. You know, we refer to this as the book of James, but a characteristic of the English language Bible tradition is that these New Testament characters who are actually called Jacob in the Greek text, we give them the name James, okay? So what you'll find in the New Testament is whenever the patriarch Jacob, you know, think of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, whenever that Jacob is mentioned, he's referred to as Jacob in English translation. But these other Jacobs, like Jacob the son of Zebedee, one of the 12 disciples, or Jesus himself has a brother named Jacob in the New Testament, those New Testament Jacobs, for whatever reason, get referred to as James. But I'd like you to be aware of that, because it is important to recognize that the way the author is describing himself is he is Jacob, writing to these 12 tribes in the dispersion, okay? You know, sometimes you'll hear where, you know, the reason maybe why this is part of the English English Bible tradition is because of King James. You know, he authorizes that famous translation back in the early 1600s. But it's important to recognize that if you go back even earlier to William Tyndale's famous translation of 1534, it's James there. So it's not that people are doing this out of deference to King James. It's just, it's got more to do with just the way that the name Jacob morphed in a lot of European languages over that 1600 years, you could say, between the time of the New Testament and when we get into the late medieval period. But anyways, the reason why this is important, at least I would see it as important, is that this person, Jacob, is writing to fellow Christians, but he refers to them as the 12 tribes. And of course, that immediately should bring to mind something. Jacob, the patriarch Jacob, is what? The father of those 12 tribes, right? The 12 sons of Jacob are the ones who become those 12 tribes of Israel. So there's there's an intentionality here in probably his use of that language of the 12 tribes. Because even though he's going to be addressing them primarily as brothers and sisters, he definitely sees, you know, that he's a brother to all of the people he's writing. At the same time, he's writing from that position of a father. Because he's doing all the things in this letter that one would expect a father to be doing. Okay, so for example, you know, if you look at just how he positions himself as the writer, he's giving them guidance, he's giving them wisdom, he's giving them instruction, what you would expect a father to do. When need arises, he gives them correction. You'll see a lot of that when the text is read later. He takes this protective view over the people that he's writing to. So one way you could understand this, there's a little bit of a play going on here then with this Jacob to the 12 tribes. He is a brother to them, but more than that, he is writing from this fatherly perspective to them. Okay. So he addresses them as 12 tribes, but also these 12 tribes who are in the dispersion. So again, there's this language that we would immediately recognize as very Jewish language, okay? 12 tribes, obviously, and the dispersion, you know, think of the whole diaspora experience of the Jewish people. When the covenant breaks down in the time of the Old Testament, what happens? The people are scattered, and that's really what diaspora or dispersion means. The Israelites, or particularly the people of Judah and Benjamin, they're scattered throughout the world at that time. But we shouldn't think that even though James is a very Jewish book, in fact, along with Matthew, it's probably the most Jewish book of the New Testament, we wouldn't want to think that he's certainly not writing to, say, a Jewish audience per se, and we certainly wouldn't want to limit it either to just Jewish Christians. Because one thing we know from just reading throughout the New Testament is that early Christians, whether they're Jewish or Gentile in terms of their ethnicity, how did they view themselves? They viewed themselves as the people of God. They viewed themselves as standing in the tradition of Israel. They viewed themselves as the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay, as Paul would put it, the Gentile believers have been grafted in to that tree of Israel, as it were. So again, he's not necessarily writing to Jewish Christians. It's probably better to think that he's writing to all the church that, again, is scattered throughout the Roman Empire at this time. It's interesting, if you look at 1 Peter, the salutation to 1 Peter, same language. He's writing to people in the diaspora, and yet it's very clear he's got primarily Gentile believers in mind. So it shows that, again, this Jewish language that's used here doesn't necessarily limit who the audience is that the author has in mind. But he is writing to people who are experiencing what we would call this diaspora experience. And so one way we can think about the book of James, just in terms of its overall theme, it's an epistle for the diaspora experience. And he wants the Christians who are reading this, he wants us, as we read this, to read this from that vantage point, that we are God's people, but we are presently living in a diaspora, okay? And again, this is common throughout the New Testament. Going back to 1 Peter, when he's addressing the Christians he's writing to, they're in the diaspora, and he describes them as what? Aliens, exiles. He uses that political language to describe them. Why? Because even though they've maybe lived in these regions their entire lives, that's where their ancestors had lived for centuries, nonetheless, because they are Christians, what does that mean? Our identity is now not defined by where we happen to live. Our identity is defined by who we follow, who we are in covenant with. Paul's thinking much the same way when he's writing to the Philippian Christians. He reminds them that what? Our citizenship is not here, right? Philippi was a Roman colony, but that's not where their true citizenship is. Their true citizenship is with Christ, right? That's what needs to define their identity. So James is writing to an audience that is very much a minority group living in this larger Roman Empire. And they're experiencing all of those things that go with being part of a diaspora. There's a vulnerability that goes with that. Again, if you're an alien or you're an exile, there's bound to be vulnerability that goes with that. We know that common to the early Christian experience was persecution in the places where they happened to be, right? And James will sort of address that. He realizes that the communities that he's writing to are under a certain amount of pressure as part of that diaspora experience. And so he wants to give them comfort. He wants to give them encouragement to live wisely and well in that type of an environment. But also another danger of the diaspora experience is the risk of compromise. You know, it's interesting, James is writing this in the first century, again, to a Jewish readership, but it would be, for a long time, it was commonplace in Judaism for Jewish writers to address the same kinds of concerns, to encourage people to remain faithful to the traditions of Israel. And James is doing much the same thing in this letter, but again, within a Christian framework. So what he's doing in this letter is basically addressing the needs, the concerns of a diaspora community. And so similar to what you would find in, say, a Jewish context where you'd find a similar kind of letter, is there's this very strong emphasis on James in remaining faithful to the law. Now that can seem a bit off-putting, all this language about the law. But again, it shouldn't surprise us. It wouldn't surprise you at all if you're familiar with Matthew. Again, other very Jewish book in the New Testament. The law is just as important within a Christian context as it is within a Jewish context. But the definition, obviously, what we mean by law, changes. But just to kind of give you a bit of a context, if you were a Jewish writer in that time period that James is living in, writing to fellow Jews, what would be the kinds of things you would be encouraging? Being faithful to the Torah in terms of what? Circumcision, Sabbath observance, keeping to the food laws, that kind of thing. It's not surprising that those issues come up so much in the New Testament, because for centuries, that's been drilled into Jewish people. This is how you remain faithful to God in the midst of a diaspora experience. James, of course, is interested in those issues. Why? Because when he's thinking of law, he's thinking of something entirely different. I give you the qualifiers, for example, that he uses when he talks about law in this letter. He refers to the perfect law or the complete law. He's sort of echoing, in a sense, what Paul is saying when Paul talks about Christ being the what? End or fulfillment or completion. He uses similar language to what Paul would use there. And also, like Paul, he refers to it as the law of freedom or the law of liberty. When Paul's talking about the Spirit that now defines the life of the believer, through the Spirit we enter into this law of liberty. But it's this law that, again, is rooted in our experience of Christ. Or he also describes the law, James describes the law as the royal law. Again, signaling to his readers that what he's thinking about is that kingdom teaching of Jesus. Jesus as the Messiah gives teaching about the kingdom. Okay, that is the royal law. So in other words, what he's doing is he's taking the same kinds of concerns that one would have found in the Jewish context, but he's now transposing that into a Christian context, where now what it means to be faithful in the diaspora is to be faithful to the teaching and the values of Jesus. Okay. So, let's look at this. Now, you know, oftentimes James is described as a wisdom book, right? So sometimes you'll see that in introductions to the book of James. It'll oftentimes be described as kind of the wisdom book of the New Testament. And that's true in part, but I would prefer to see James as it very much is echoing the Old Testament canon. in many respects. Because if you think of the Old Testament scriptures, you've got the Torah there at the very beginning, the teaching of Moses, the teaching that God gives to Israel through Moses. And that becomes the foundation and basis of everything. And what do you have in the Old Testament? Out of Torah comes the wisdom tradition, and out of Torah comes the prophetic tradition. So the Torah gives birth to both of those famous traditions in the Old Testament. Same thing you see in the book of James. It's the law of Christ that is front and center. That's where our focus needs to be. But out of the teaching of Jesus comes what? Wisdom. And out of the teaching of Jesus comes a prophetic impulse, as we will see. Okay. But he definitely wants these Christians to be wise within that context of diaspora. So I just give you a sampling here. He starts the letter by saying, do any of you lack wisdom? Well, ask God, and he will give you wisdom. Later, he's going to say, do you think you have wisdom? Show that by your good life. Okay. Again, one thing you'll pick up on from the reading is this emphasis on not just being a hearer of the teaching of Jesus, but a doer. It needs to affect our lives if we're truly going to be faithful people living in the midst of diaspora. Okay. Think of Jesus teaching, one of the famous, so much of, one way to think about the book of James is it's a bunch of mini sermons all rooted in sayings of Jesus. And particularly, again, from Matthew, there's this close correspondence between James and Matthew. So think, for example, of Jesus teaching the Sermon on the Mount. Who's the wise builder? The one who builds his house upon the rock. And who is that describing? Jesus says, it's the one who hears my words and does them. That's the wise person. James is basically picking up on that same point. But he also puts these diaspora Christians on notice. There is such a thing as a wisdom from above, that wisdom that comes from God, but be careful you don't confuse that with this wisdom from below, right? We need to be very careful we aren't adopting the value system of the diaspora in which we are positioned and confusing those values for the wisdom that comes from above, for that wisdom that is rooted in Jesus' teaching. But there's also, in next slide, there's also this strong prophetic impulse in the book of James. So again, the teaching, the Torah, it gives birth to a wisdom, but it also gives birth to this prophetic impulse. And James can be very hard-hitting as a prophet, right? Some of the most stern prophetic words you have in the New Testament are found in the book of James. I just give you a sampling here, but note, there's very much a prophetic kind of statement. Friendship with the world is what? Enmity with God. Again, if we buy into the value system of this present age, we are no longer walking with God. Okay. He's also concerned that there might be fragmentation within the community. Again, he uses language of brothers and sisters so often because he wants them to cultivate that sense that we're in this together. We need to have each other's back. We need to be supportive of each other. And therefore, he has little patience for those who would judge a fellow believer. And so again, whoever judges another judges the law. Basically what? Judges God, because you're judging the very instruction and teaching that God has given you. Okay. And then you've got, again, the community he's writing to, he identifies them as more or less a poor community. Because again, part of their isolation within that diaspora context. If you're a first century Christian, there was a lot of economic deprivation that went with being a Christian. There's a lot of things you had to give up. There were a lot of business things that would just collapse around you. So it was not uncommon for first century Christians to experience poverty because of their commitment to Christ. It's not surprising that that's how he portrays his audience. And therefore, who are those who oftentimes oppress them? The wealthy, those who are taking advantage of their situation. And if you look at chapter 5, which will be read later, weep and wail, you rich. I mean, James is as hard-hitting in that passage as what you're ever going to find in a book like Amos or Micah or some of the other prophets when they're in full gear as far as a condemnatory prophetic word that they need to give to others. So there is that prophetic element to James. And this brings us to the closing of the book, because one way we can see where this prophetic aspect of James shows through is in the very way he wants to conclude the letter. And I'll read that to you. My brothers and sisters, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and is brought back by another, you should know that whoever brings back a sinner from wandering will save the sinner's soul and will cover a multitude of sins. Again, the language he's using here is, again, so reminiscent of what you would find in prophetic texts, where Israel at times would what? Stray from covenant. They would stray from the Torah, stray from the wisdom and instruction of the Lord. What's the job of a prophet in that kind of a context? To bring the person back, to bring them back onto the correct path, bring them back into covenant faithfulness. And that's how James chooses to end his letter, on that note, that we all have a responsibility to each other. You know, we have a responsibility for our own lives as disciples of Jesus to make sure that we are walking in faithfulness to Christ. But we also have a responsibility to the brother and sister, because not everybody's going to necessarily navigate this diaspora experience wisely and well. And some are going to be unduly influenced by the pressures around them. It's our job to what? Seek those people out. Do that prophetic role of seeking them out and drawing them back into the fold, as it were. You know, it's interesting, this language of straying, so often in the New Testament used as what? The lost sheep. Same kind of language is used in the lost sheep parable, for example. There's a tendency of people to stray, to get lost. We have that responsibility to bring people back. So just a few things I'd like you to keep in mind as we then enter into this series is, first of all, how is your diaspora experience? Again, we're all, sometimes we don't use this, perhaps we don't use this language as much as we should in church, because it's all over the place in the New Testament. Sometimes I feel maybe we've become too comfortable in our, you know, in our North American context, where our values end up just blending with the values of the dominant culture. It's important for us to remind ourselves what the New Testament authors are continually reminding first century Christians. You are in a diaspora experience. How well are you doing in that diaspora experience? Are you maturing? Are you keeping faithful to the teaching of Christ? Are you representing him well in this context? And also, are you taking responsibility for others within that context? So what we'll do next is, Mike and Josh will come up and they will take us through the letter. Yes.
Can we give a round of applause to say thank you to Dr. Charette?